We present Rites of Passage by William Golding, adapted for radio by Don Taylor. With Samuel West as Edmund Talbot and Simon Russell Beale as Parson Colley. Episode 3.
There is light falling through the Louvre into my cabin. It must be dawn. I have been awake all night reading Colley's manuscript. When I first agreed to keep for your lordship this journal of my voyage to the Antipodes, I never anticipated I would find myself writing what I now must write. Captain Anderson's injustice to the Reverend Colley, Summers firing the gun, Deverell and Cumbersham, my own behaviour, even my own character, must all be seen in a different light. Poor Colley. Poor Robert James Colley. If there is justice in the world, you can see from the state of my writing how the thing has worked on me. So what am I to do with this manuscript, this unfinished letter? I ought to give it to the captain, but it would go overboard, and Colley would have died of a low fever. If I myself suppress it, my own role would disappear with it, for I am ripped down in this record plainer than I intended. Well, I will not suppress it. Justice was the word. And for that I must place the evidence in your lordship's hands. I shall glue Colley's letter into my journal, where your eyes may see it all. One thing is sure, his sister must never know. Never see the letter. Let it be a low fever for her. He willed himself to death, certainly. But for what? One casual drunken folly? What happened in the forecastle? So to shame his cloth that... It is madness to imagine. What women are there at that end of the ship? There is no room for further speculation. You must hear Colley speak now, in his own voice.
My prolonged nausea has rendered those first hours and days a little less distinct in my memory, but I am now sufficiently recovered to hold a pen, and cannot refrain from harking back for a moment to my first appearance on the vessel.
Sir, I wonder if you can direct me...
Oh, God, a parson. That will send old Rumbleguts flying into the foretop.
My dear sister, that was but a sample of what I was to suffer. Now I am recovered somewhat, my first duty, of course, must be to make myself known to our gallant captain, who lives and has his being some two stories or decks above us. I am surrounded on all sides by our sailor heroes. They go about their tasks, their bronzed and manly forms unclothed to the waist, their nether garments closely fitted, but flared about the ankles like the nostrils of a stallion. The masts may be likened to huge trees, among the limbs and branches of which our bronzed fellows climb. It is night now. I have a sense of the awfulness and majesty of his creation, and the splendor of our vessel. Separate world in which we must pass our lives and receive our reward or punishment. I cannot tell you how high against the stars our great masts seem, how huge yet airy her sails, nor how far down from her deck the night-glittering surface of the waters. While I was there on deck, the breeze fell, so that the glitter, that image of the starry heavens, gave way to a flatness and blackness. All was mystery. It terrified me, and I turned away to find myself staring at the half-seen face of Mr. Smiles, the sailing master.
Mr. Smiles, tell me how deep these waters are.
Who can say, Mr. Carly? They may be more than a mile deep. 2 miles. You might sound as softly dead, but commonly you do not. is not the necessity.
More than a mile.
I was almost overcome with faintness. Here we are, suspended between the land below the waters and the sky, like a nut on a leaf on a pond. I cannot convey to you, dear sister, my sense of horror at our being living souls in this place where, surely, no man ought to be. I wrote that last night by the light of a most expensive candle. Yet I am forced in on myself, and must be allowed a little light. It is in circumstances such as these that a man, even if he make the fullest use of the consolations of his religion, requires human companionship.
Philip?
Yes, Mr. Colley.
The ladies and gentlemen at this end of the ship do not respond to my greetings with any cheerful alacrity. Are they, as the saying is, shy of a parson?
Well, sir.
Now tell me, Phillips, do not be reticent.
It may be that it is thought among the common people, sir, that a parson is like a woman in a fishing boat, a bringer of bad luck.
That is a low and reprehensible superstition, Phillips.
I'm sure it is, sir.
One member of our company has taken some small note of me. He is a young gentleman I trust and hope will become my friend as the voyage advances. He is a member of the aristocracy, with all the consideration and nobility of bearing that such birth implies. I have made bold to salute him on a number of occasions, and he has responded graciously. I have thought of at least one possible reason for the indifference with which I feel myself treated. I have not made myself known to our captain, and this may well have been thought a slight upon him. I am determined to undo this misapprehension as soon as possible. I attended to my clothes with more than usual care, came out of my cabin, and ascended the flight of stairs to that highest deck where the captain commonly stations himself. At the front end of this deck, the captain and Mr. Summers were at the wheel together, staring at the compass. I waited till the captain turned away, and walked to the very back of the vessel, and followed him.
Get out!
Excuse me, Captain, I'm the Reverend Robert James Colley at your service.
Are you indeed? Passengers come to the quarter deck by invitation. I'm not accustomed to these interruptions in my water. Go forward, if you please, and keep to leeward.
Leeward, sir?
Get off!
Mr. Colley, Mr. Summers, take care. You must come to this side of the ship, sir. That side of the deck from which the wind blows, whichever side it may be, is reserved for the captain.
I knew nothing of that, Mr. Summers.
No, sir.
I can see I'm at fault, but by an ignorance natural in a gentleman who has not been at sea before.
You should leave the quarter deck now, sir.
Yes, indeed.
I shall.
This surliness of the captain towards me is not easily explained. I had determined to emerge more frequently from my obscurity and exhibit my cloth to this gentleman and the passengers in general, so that even if they do not respect me, they may respect it. It is evident I must return to the captain and offer him my sincere apologies for my inadvertent trespass. As soon as I had written the foregoing paragraph, I went up to the quarterdeck. The captain stood at the stern rail with his back to me, while Mr. Summers was supervising the two men at the wheel.
We are now in finer weather, Mr. Summers, sir.
Mr. Colley! Mr. Colley! Come here, sir!
Be quick, Mr. Colley. Wish to speak to me, Captain?
Mr. Colley, do you wish to subvert all my officers?
Subvert?
It was my word, sir.
There is some mistake.
It is yours, then, sir. Are you aware of the powers of a captain in his own ship?
They are rightly extensive, but as an ordained minister...
You are a passenger, sir. Neither more nor less. What is more, you are not behaving as decent as the rest.
Sir.
You are a nuisance, sir. You was put aboard this ship without a note from me. There's more courtesy shown me about a bale and a keg, sir. Then I did you the credit to suppose you could read.
Read? Captain Anderson, of course I can read.
But despite my plainly written orders, no sooner had you recovered from your sickness than you have twice approached and exasperated my officers.
I know nothing of this. I've read nothing.
They are my standing orders, sir. A paper prominently displayed near your quarters and those of the other passengers.
My attention was not drawn.
Stuff and nonsense, sir. You have a servant, and the orders are there.
My attention was not...
Your ignorance is no excuse. If you wish to have the same freedom as the other passengers enjoy in the after part of the vessel, or do you not wish to live among ladies and gentlemen, sir? Go, examine the paper.
It is my right.
Read it, sir. And when you have read it, get it by heart.
How, sir, will you treat me like a schoolboy?
I will treat you like a schoolboy if I choose, sir. Or I will put you in irons if I choose. Or have you flogged at the gratings if I choose. Or have you hanged at the yardarm if I choose.
Sir,
do you doubt my authority?
I will indulge you in this, Captain Anson.
You will carry out my orders.
I turned away and withdrew silently. I found my body bathed in perspiration, yet strangely cold, though my face, by some contrast, was as strangely hot. I was weeping. I wish I could say they were tears of manly wrath, but the truth is they were tears of shame. I searched for the captain's written orders. I remembered that Phillips had indeed mentioned them during the convulsions of my sickness. They were displayed on a wall near the cabins, behind glass, somewhat blurred on the inside by condensation, but readable. Passengers are in no case to speak to officers who are executing some duty about the ship. In no case are they to address the officers of the watch. I realized what a hideous situation I was in. The officer of the watch must have been Mr. Summers, which is why he did not answer my greeting. My fault had been quite inadvertent, but nonetheless real. Even though the manner of Captain Anderson towards me had not been that of a gentleman, yet some form of apology was due to him. I quickly committed the essential words to memory and returned to the quarterdeck. I approached the captain's back and waited for him to turn. And he walked through me. He struck me on the shoulder with his arm, and then his chest struck me in the face, so that I went reeling.
Get up, sir. Get up at once. Is there no end to your impertinent folly?
Captain Anderson, you asked me.
I asked nothing of you, sir. I gave you an order.
My apology.
I did not ask for an apology. We are not on land, but at sea. Your apology is a matter of indifference to me.
Nevertheless.
Am I to be outfaced again and again on my own deck by every ignorant landsman who cares to walk there? Am I? Tell me.
My apology was intended.
I am more concerned with your person, sir, which is more apparent to me than your mind, and which has formed the habit of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Repeat your lesson, sir.
Passengers.
Come, sir. Repeat your lesson.
A period for recollection. A period.
Very well. Come back when you can do it. You understand?
I shall make every. I shall earnestly attempt.
Well, sir, what are you waiting for?
I did not so much go to my cabin as flee to it. As I approached the second flight of stairs, I saw Mr. Talbot and the two young gentlemen he had with him hurry out of sight into the lobby. I fell down the stairs into my cabin and flung myself down by my bunk.
Allow me to tell you, Mr. Taylor, Miss Willis, that a gentleman does not rejoice at the misfortune of others in public. You may make your bows and be off.
God bless you, sir.
God bless Mr. Talbot. There is one true gentleman in this ship, and I pray that before we reach our destination, I may tell him how much his true consideration has meant to me.
However I turn the thing over in my mind, there is no doubt that I am an object of a particular animosity on the part of the captain. It was not an accident when he walked through me. Captain Anderson deliberately struck me down. It is true I had been foolish and perhaps an object of scorn to all the officers and gentlemen, with the exception of Mr. Talbot. But with all humility, so would my master have been. So, my dear sister... Yet I see already that much of what I have written would be too painful for your eyes and must be softened. And yet... If not to my sister, to whom? To thee. I am addressing thee, O most merciful Saviour. I concluded after long prayer that it would be proper to do either of two things. Never to return to the quarterdeck, but for the remainder of our passage hold myself aloof from it with dignity. Or to go to the quarterdeck, repeat Captain Anderson's orders to him, and add some such cool remark as, "And now, Captain Anderson, I will trouble you no further." but he might not afford me the opportunity of uttering it. Better to pursue the first course and give him no further occasion to insult me. Like Robinson Crusoe, I consider what part of the vessel remained to me as my kingdom. It comprised my cabin, the corridor or lobby outside it, the passenger saloon, the necessary offices on this side of the ship, and the deck, or waist, as Phillips calls it, as far as the white line which separates us from the common people. Immediately I went out and paced round my kingdom. Though I have, so to speak, abdicated from that part of the vessel which ought to be the prerogative of my cloth, the waist is in some ways to be preferred to the quarter-deck. Though I salute our ladies and gentlemen when I see them up there, they seldom acknowledge me. Mr. Talbot is the exception. I have seen him not merely walk to the white line, but cross it and go among the common people in a generous and democratic freedom. I have furthered my acquaintance with Mr. Talbot. He is a true friend to religion. He came to my cabin and begged me, in the most friendly and open manner, to favour the ship's people with a short address. I did so in the passenger saloon. I cannot pretend that many of the gentry paid much attention, and only one of the officers was present. I therefore addressed myself particularly to those hearts I thought open: Miss Brocklebank, a young lady of great piety and beauty, and Mr. Talbot, whose devotion does credit not only to him, but the whole nobility of England. Phillips?
Yes, Mr. Collins.
The waist is awash today. We cannot walk there.
No, sir.
But you see, in spite of the weather, I have become a proper sailor.
Yes, sir. Was there anything particular you wanted, sir?
I have not seen Mr. Talbot lately.
No, sir. He is very sick, sir.
Oh, is it mal de mer?
I don't know, sir. Maybe it's something he ate, eh?
Perhaps I shall visit him.
Excuse me, sir.
Mr. Talbot, sir. He seems to be asleep. Daring still further, I lifted the latch and entered. The young man lay asleep, a week's beard on his cheeks and chin. I scarce dare put down here the impression his slumbering countenance made on me. It was the face of one who suffered for us all. I bent over him in an irresistible compulsion, sensing the sweet aroma of holiness on his breath. I did not think myself worthy of his lips, but pressed my own reverently on the one hand that lay outside the coverlet. Such is the power of goodness that I withdrew as from an altar. The ship is crowded at the front end. There is a small group of soldiers in uniform and a few emigrants. But it is the seamen who seem objects of astonishment to me. You may observe them when they are released from duty, to stand with their arms linked or placed about each other's shoulders. They sleep sometimes on the deck, one, it may be, with his head pillowed upon another's breast. The innocent pleasures of friendship, in which I, alas, have as yet so little experience, the joy of kindly association, or even that bond between two persons which, Holy Writ tells us, passes the love of women, must be the cement that holds their company together. It has indeed seemed to me that the life at the front end of the vessel is sometimes to be preferred to the vicious system of control which obtains aft of the mainmast. Alas, that my calling and the degree in society consequent upon it should set me so firmly where I no longer desire to be.
The weather is bad today, Phillips.
Yes, sir. You should keep to the lobby, sir, not venture into the waist. Most of the ladies and gentlemen keep their cabins.
I believe Mr. Talbot still keeps his. Is he seasick?
No, sir. It's not that.
I've heard some strange noises emanating from behind his door.
Yes, sir. Wheeler's saying to him, sir.
I think I should perhaps offer my services.
Who's there?
It's I, Mr. Talbot, sir. Mr. Colley, sir. You remember? The Reverend Mr. Colley at your service. It is part of my duty...
Excuse me, I beg you, Mr. Colley.
...to visit the sick.
I can't answer that.
Ah.
he is wrestling with his soul.
Could be that, sir.
Far be it for me to blame him, but the sounds were those of enthusiasm. When he is fit enough to move among us again, it shall be my pleasant duty to bring him back to that moderation in religion which is the particular genius of the Church of England.
Is there anything you actually want, sir?
No, Phillips, I think not.
Right, sir.
This morning in the waste, I have been spectator once again of that scene which moves me with a mixture of grief and admiration. A barrel is set on the deck. The seamen stand in line and each is given successively a mug of liquid from the barrel, which, after toasting the king, he drains off. I know that the liquid is the devil's brew, yet here, under the hot sun, and with a whole company of bronzed young fellows bared to the waist, if there was no overthrowing of my opinion, there was at least a mitigation of it. Watching one young fellow in particular, a narrow-waisted, slim-hipped, yet broad-shouldered child of Neptune, I felt that some of what was malignant in the potion was cancelled by where and who was concerned with it. My particular hero had four or five white scratches on the left side of his open and amiable countenance, as if, like Hercules, he had struggled with a wild beast. I was much taken with his manly grace, and found myself in my kingdom of lobby, cabin, and waste, unexpectedly dethroned. For this young man of bronze, it seemed to me that he could be no other than a king. I abdicated freely, and yearned to kneel before him. My whole heart went out in a passionate longing to bring this young man to our Saviour, first and surely richest fruit of the harvest I am sent forth to garner. We are in the doldrums. Mr. Talbot avoids me. He has been wandering round the ship and descending into her very bowels, as if searching for some private place where he may continue his devotions without hindrance. I fear my approach was untimely, but I pray for him. What more can I do? The sea is polished. There is no sky, but only a hot whiteness that descends like a curtain on every side. Our own motionlessness has increased the effluvias that rise from the necessary soiling of the waters immediately round us. I sit in my cabin in shirt and breeches, and even so find the air hardly to be borne. I was sitting thus at my writing flap cutting a quill when I heard a scuffle in the lobby.
Now, Cabral, I saw you come from the cabin.
What are you about then, Cumbersome, you rogue?
Give it to me, sir. By God, I'll have it.
Unopen at either end. You sly dog, Cumbersome. Sure. I'll read it. I swear I will.
You bastard.
Oh, for Christ's sake, man.
Gentlemen.
Who the devil is this, Cumbersome?
It's a parson, I think.
Be off, sir. About your own business?
I am about my business, my friends, and I exhort you in a spirit of Christian charity to cease this unseemly behaviour and unseemly language and make up your quarrel.
By thunder!
Who, in the name of all that's wonderful, gave you permission to preach in this ship?
Yes, Cumbersome, you have a point.
Leave this to me, Deverell. Now, parson, if that's what you are, show us your authority.
Authority?
Damn it, man. I mean your commission.
Commission?
License, they call it, Cumbersome, old fellow. License to preach. Right, parson. Show us your license.
Well, of course. It is in my trunk with my other private papers somewhere.
Be off with you then, sir. Or I will take you before the captain.
I must confess that threat set me hurrying back into my cabin with considerable trepidation. I concluded that their laughter must have been at the sartorial error I made in not appearing before them fully clothed for my calling, rather than the business of my license. I record this trivial episode to show the oddities of behaviour, the strangeness of this life in this strange part of the world, among strange people, and in this strange construction of English oak, which both imprisons and transports me.
May I have a word with you, Mr. Colley?
By all means, sir, but please do not enter. I am not prepared either in clothing or visage for an interview.
As you please, sir. I must ask your pardon that there have been no more services. I have repeatedly sounded the passengers, but met with indifference.
You asked Mr. Talbot?
Mr. Talbot has been much preoccupied with his own affairs. There might be a chance of a small gathering next Sabbath.
This is a godless vessel.
It is the influence of a certain person.
Do not, I beg you, Mr. Colley, entertain such thoughts. A small gathering, a hymn or two, a reading and a benediction.
A morning service in the waste will be far more appropriate.
No, sir, that cannot be. Excuse me, sir, I must go.
Since the captain inflicted a public humiliation upon me, were it not for Phillips and Mr. Summers, I believe I should speak to no one. For poor Mr. Talbot has been either indisposed or restlessly moving towards what I can only suppose to be a crisis of faith. I have been again into the waist. The ladies and gentlemen were parading on the quarter-deck, where I must not go. I did bow to them from far off, but the distance was too great, and they did not notice me. The ship is motionless, her sails hanging vertically down like aged cheeks. But as I turned and faced the forward part of the ship, I saw something strange and new. The people are fastening what I at first took for an awning before the forecastle. It is stretched across the deck at the height of the bulwarks, from which it is suspended by ropes. Of all the strangenesses of this place at the world's end, the change in our ship at this moment is the strangest. There is silence, broken only by bursts of laughter. The people, with every indication of enjoyment, are lowering buckets over the side and heaving up the seawater, which must, I fear, be most impure, since we have been stationary for several hours, and spilling it into the tarpaulin, which is now bellied down by the weight. There seems no way this can help our progress, the more so as certain of the people, my young hero among them, I'm afraid, have, so to say, relieved nature into it. I was disgusted by the sight, and returned to my cabin.
Mr. Collins, sir, just a moment.
What is it, Phillips?
Go on into your cabin, sir. Lock the door.
Silence, Phillips! You dog!
Yes, Mr. Commissioner, sir. Yes.
Yes?
Mr. Collins, sir. I beg you to...
Phillips, you dog! Get below. I'll have you at the grating.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Commissioner. Oh, Mr. Devereaux. What is the meaning of this?
I stared at them in astonishment as they went, but they were both to some degree in drink. The ship is extraordinarily quiet. A few minutes ago, I heard the steps of the remainder of the passengers go through the lobby, mount the stairs, and pass over my head. There is no doubt about it. The people at this end of the ship are gathered on the quarterdeck. Only I am excluded from them. I stole out into the strange light. The lobby was silent. Only a confused murmur came from Mr. Talbot's cabin. I had a great mind to go to him and beg his protection, but I knew he was at private prayer. I stole out of the lobby into the waist. What I saw will be stamped on my mind till my dying day. Our end of the ship was crowded with passengers and officers, all silent and all staring forward over my head. Our huge ship was motionless and her sails still hung down. On her right hand, the red sun was setting, and on her left, the full moon was rising, the one directly across from the other. The two vast luminaries seemed to stare at each other. Here, plainly to be seen, were the very scales of God. The people moved about and hung lanterns by the dozen from the rigging, so that I saw now that they had erected something like a bishop's cathedra above the ungainly paunch of the tarpaulin. I began to understand. I began to tremble. I was alone. In that vast ship, with her numberless souls, I was alone in a place where, on a sudden, I feared the justice of God, unmitigated by his mercy. I dreaded both God and man. I stumbled back to my cabin and attempted to pray. I had completed my devotions and divested myself of my garments except my shirt, when I heard someone coming along the lobby.
What is it? What is it?
Open this door!
No, no, I am unclothed, but what is it?
Robert James Colley, you are come to judgment.
No, no, I am not in any way ready. I mean, I am unclothed.
Robert James Colley, you are called to appear before the throne.
No, no.
I made for the door to shoot the bolt, but as I did so, the door burst open. Two huge figures with heads of nightmare, great eyes and mouths, black mouths full of a mess of fangs, drove down at me.
You are chosen, Collie, to appear before the king.
A cloth was thrust over my head. I was seized and hurried away by irresistible force, my feet not able to find the deck, except every now and then.
Help! Help me, dear savior!
The cloth was wrenched off, and I saw the foredeck was full of people, and lined with figures of nightmare akin to those who had hurried me away. He who sat on the throne before me was bearded, and crowned with flame, and bore a huge fork with three prongs in his right hand. Twisting my neck, I could see the after end of the ship was thronged with spectators. Now I understood the cruelty of the jest. Some of my fear was swallowed up in shame at appearing before the ladies and gentlemen half-naked. I, who had thought never to appear but in the ornaments of the spiritual man.
I fear I am to be part of some jest, but may I please have some decent covering?
Leo, Collie!
Put him down there!
I beg you, I beg you.
Now for the interrogation!
Before I could say any more, a question was put to me of such grossness that I will not remember it, much less write it down. Yet as I opened my mouth to protest, it was at once filled with such nauseous stuff, I am like to vomit, remembering it. And when I would not open my mouth, it was smeared on my face.
Collie! Listen, you devil, when the king of the sea speaks. You are a low, filthy fellow, and must be shampooed!
There was such pain and nausea and hindrance to my breathing. I was in desperate fear I would die there and then. Just when I thought my end was come, I was projected backwards with extreme violence into the port of filthy water. It was strange and terrible. I had not harmed them. Yet now, as I struggled each time to get out of the wallowing, slippery paunch, I heard what the poor victims of the French terror must have heard in their last moments, and oh, nothing, nothing that men can do to each other can be compared with that snarling, lustful appetite. I had abandoned hope of life when I was aware of repeated shouts from the quarterdeck and a tremendous explosion. The hands that had been thrusting me down now lifted me up and out. I fell upon the deck and lay there. Then I began to crawl away in a trail of filth. But there was another shouted order, and hands lifted me up and bore me to my cabin. Later, I do not know how much later, the door opened and some Christian soul, it may have been Phillips, placed a bucket of hot water by me, with which I slowly succeeded in getting myself comparatively clean. I will not be bitter. I will forgive. They are my brothers. Even if they feel not so. Even if I feel not so. And one among them, Mr. Summers, or maybe Mr. Talbot, did intervene and effect an interruption to their brutal sport. What a man does defiles him, not what is done by others. My shame, though it burn, has been inflicted on me. What have the servants of the Lord been promised in this world but persecution? I am not alone. Yet the true insult is to my cloth, to the great army of which I am the last and littlest soldier. My master has been insulted, and I have a duty to deliver a rebuke rather than suffer in silence. Not for ourselves, O Lord, but for thee. I slept more peacefully after writing those words, and woke to find the ship running easily before a moderate wind.
Phillips!
Yes, Mr. Collins.
I need my hood and my square and his lordship's license. They are all in my trunk.
We can't get to your trunk, sir, without great trouble.
I must have them. I must appear in my full spiritual garb.
I'll do what I can, sir.
While Phillips was busy finding my trunk, I mounted up to the quarterdeck.
Captain Anderson, I desire to speak with you.
Well, sir, you may do so.
Captain Anderson, your people have done my office wrong. You yourself have done it wrong.
I know it, Mr. Colley.
You confess as much, sir?
It was never meant. The affair got out of hand. You have been ill-used, sir.
Captain Anderson, after this confession of your fault, I forgive you freely. But there were other officers involved, acting not so much under your orders as by your example. Theirs was perhaps the most outrageous insult to my cloth. I believe I know them, sir. Not for my sake, but for their own, they must admit the fault.
You will have it all, then.
I defend my master's honor as you would defend the king's.
I will speak to the officers concerned. Are you now satisfied?
Let them come to me, sir, and they shall receive my forgiveness as freely as I have given it to you. But there is another thing.
For Christ's sake!
There are also the poor, ignorant people in the front end of the ship. I must visit them and bring them to repentance.
Are you mad?
Indeed, no, sir.
Have you no care for what further mockery may be inflicted on you?
You have your uniform, Captain Anderson, and I have mine. I shall approach them in those ornaments of the spiritual man.
Uniform?
Do you not understand, sir? I shall go to them in those garments which my long study and ordination enjoin on me. You know me for what I am.
I do indeed, sir.
Have I your permission, then, to go forward and address them?
Do as you please.
Mr. Colley.
Well, my friend. Mr. Colley, I beg you to consider what you are about. Had I not discharged Mr. Prettyman's weapon over the side, there is no knowing how far the affair might have gone. I beg you, sir, let me assemble them under the eyes of their officers.
Come, Mr. Summers, I shall appear to them in the raiment in which I might conduct a service. They will recognize it and respect it.
At least wait till after they have been given their rum. Believe me, sir, I know whereof I speak. It will render them calmer, more receptive to what you have to say. I beg you, sir. Otherwise, contempt, indifference, and who knows what else.
And the lesson would go unheeded, you think?
Indeed, sir.
Very well, Mr. Summers. I will wait till later in the morning. I have some writing to do.
I had hardly settled myself to this writing when there came a knock at my door.
Who is it?
Mr. Deverell, Mr. Colley, and Mr. Cumbersham.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Mr. Colley, I have to say to you that there were mistakes made last night. I was a little in drink, sir.
And so was I, Mr. Colley.
I did not think you'd take it so much to heart, sir. The people are accustomed to that kind of sport when the ship crosses the line.
The line?
The equator, sir. It is a traditional thing, sir.
Not a tradition to be greatly honoured, I think.
I regret that we misinterpreted the captain's general permission.
The captain gave permission?
In general way, sir. But the jest got out of hand. No one meant any harm, and I hope you may now forget the whole business.
I forgive you freely, gentlemen, as I am enjoined to by my master. Go and sing no more.
I wonder who the devil his master is.
I think he's in with the damned captain to the fleet.
When they had departed, I own I felt at peace for the first time in many days. I shall now put on my canonicals and go forward and rebuke these unruly but truly lovable children of our Maker. It seems to me that I am consumed by a great love of all things. The sea, the ship, the sky, the gentlemen and the people, and of our Redeemer above all. All things praise him.
As your lordship can see, Colley wrote no more. After death, nothing. I must ensure that his poor sister will never know the truth of it, what weakness killed him, nor whose hands, mine among them, struck him down.
When I was roused by Wheeler from a too brief and uneasy sleep, I found that the first part of the morning was to be spent in an inquiry in which I was to sit with Summers and the captain.
So then, Mr. Taylor, he was given rum.
I've never seen a man light up so, sir. Like a lamp.
Some respect, please, Mr. Taylor. The man is dead.
Yes, sir.
How did he come to take it?
He agreed to take you for the men, sir, in the spirit of something or other. I can't quite recall what.
Might it be reconciliation?
Yes, sir, that was it.
What were you doing there forward in the first place?
I was inspecting the storage of the cable, sir, with the view to having the cable to the bow anchor rousted out and walked in friend.
I see. In that case, what were you doing outside the cable locker?
I finished the inspection, sir, and was coming up to report. But I stayed for a while because I'd never seen a parson in that state before.
And then?
I've been at Arthur, sir, to inform Mr. Summers. But I was given a bottle by Mr. Cumbersham for I could do so.
All right, Mr. Taylor, you may go.
Thanks, sir.
Mr. East.
A bottle, Summers. What the devil did they want?
A bottle is a rebuke, sir. Let us get on. Sit down, Mr. East.
Thank you, sir. Mr. East is one of the immigrants, sir.
Yes, he is.
You have a sick wife, Mr. East.
Yes, sir.
I trust she is improving.
Oh, she's a little better, sir. Thank you.
Well, Mr. East, you know Mr. Colley?
I know him by sight, sir.
And did you see what happened to him in the badger bag?
No, sir. My wife was very poorly at the time, and I was constantly with her. I heard tell of it, sir.
I'm sure you did.
I did catch a glimpse of Mr. Colley, sir, among the sailors when he came forward. I don't think he said that much before taking a cut with him.
What occasioned the applause and laughter?
Well, that was after Mr. Colley had spoken a few social words with the sailors.
And what about the growls and anger?
Oh, I know nothing about that, sir. All I know is that the sailors took the reverend gentleman away with them down where the gentleman Mr. Taylor had been, among the ropes. I know nothing more than that. I was with my wife all the time.
Yes, I see.
I hope you will think it no disrespect, sir, but that is all anyone knows, except the sailors who took the reverend gentleman in charge.
All right, Mr. East, you may withdraw. Thank you for your cooperation.
Thank you, sir.
Well, Mr. Talbot...
It seems to me that the only man who will be able to enlighten us will be the fellows who carried him back on deck when he was drunk.
Yes.
He ought to know how much Colley drank, at least, and who gave it to him, or forced it on him.
I agree. I have already ordered him to attend.
Oh, good.
My informant advises me that he is the witness we should press.
Captain, do you not believe we are making heavy weather of it? The man was made drunk. There are some men whose conscience is so tender they will die of what Mr. Brocklebank would hardly accept as a peccadillo. Could we not confess that his intemperance killed him? But that our general indifference to his welfare was likely enough the cause of it.
Indifference, sir?
Intemperance, sir. Let us leave it at that.
One moment, Mr. Summers. Mr. Talbot, I pass over your odd phrase, our general indifference. But do you not understand? Do you think that a single bout of drink...
You yourself said, sir, let us include all under a low fever.
That was yesterday. Sir, I tell you, it is likely enough that the man suffered a criminal assault by one or God knows how many men, and the absolute humiliation of it killed him.
Good God. If I may submit, sir, ought we not let that matter rest in decent obscurity, and admit rather to a certain indifference upon our, or indeed the whole company's part?
No, Mr. Summers. I will have no concealment. Nor will I tolerate frivolous accusations which touch me myself in my conduct of the ship and in my attitude to the passengers in her.
I have made a submission, sir. I beg your pardon if you find it beyond the line of my duty.
But, Captain, no man will admit to that.
You are young, Mr. Talbot. You cannot guess what channels of information there are in a ship such as this, even though her present commission has been of such a short duration.
Channels? You mean your informant?
I would prefer us to get on. Let the man come in.
I'll get him, sir.
Summers tells me you have claimed some skill in cross-examination.
Did he? I'm not sure I intended to convey...
Thank you, Summers. Your witness, Mr. Talbot.
Oh, well. Now, my good man, your name, if you please.
Billy Rogers, my Lord Fortalman.
We want information from you, Rogers. We want to know in precise detail what happened when the gentleman came among you the other day.
What gentleman, my Lord?
The parson, the Reverend Mr. Colley, who is now dead.
He took a drop too much, my Lord, was overcome like.
How came you by those scars on your face?
A wench, my Lord.
She must have been a wildcat, then.
Nine on, my Lord.
You will have your way, whether or no.
I don't know about that, my Lord. All I know is she had what was left of my pay in her other hand and would have been through the door like a pistol shot if I not took a firm hold of her.
With your permission, my Lord. Now, Rogers, never mind the women. What about the men?
Sir?
Mr. Colley suffered an outrage there in the forecastle. Who did it? Oh, come, Rogers! Would it surprise you to know that you yourself are suspected of this particular kind of beastliness?
Oh, no, nothing, Captain, sir, nothing at all.
It may not have anything to do with you, my man, but you will know who it was.
Who was who, sir?
The one or many among you who inflicted a criminal assault on the gentleman so that he died of it.
Oh, no, nothing, nothing at all.
Come, Rogers, you were the one man we saw him with. In default of any other evidence, your name must head the list of suspects. What did you sailors do?
What did we do, my Lord?
Well, doubtless you have witnesses to testify to your innocence.
If you are innocent, then help us to bring the criminals to book. I mean, my good man, you can either tell us who did it, or at the very least you can furnish us with a list of the people you suspect or know to be suspected of this particular form of interest, of assault.
Buggery, Rogers, that's what he means. Buggery, come along, man. We cannot sit here all day.
Aye, sir. Shall I begin with the officers, sir?
Very well, Rogers. That will be all. You may return to your duties.
Aye, sir.
Witnesses, inquiries, accusations, lies, more lies, court-martial. The man has it in his power to ruin us all if he would be brazen enough, as I doubt not he is. But it would be a hanging matter. Such accusations cannot be disproved. Whatever the upshot, something would stick. And there, Mr. Summers, ends our investigation. Have we other informants?
I believe no, sir. Touch pitch.
Just so. Mr. Talbot?
I am all at sea, sir. But it is true enough. The man was at bay and brought out his last weapon. False witness amounting to blackmail.
In fact, Mr. Talbot is the only one of us to have profited. He had at least a temporary elevation to the peerage.
I have returned to Earth.
You will drink, gentlemen? Paul Hawkins in Summers, will you?
Hawkins.
I must thank you for your assistance, Mr. Talbot.
Of little use, I fear, sir.
A low fever, then. Sherry?
Sir, thank you, sir. Can that be the end of it? We still do not know what happened. You mentioned informant.
This is a good sherry. I believe, Mr. Summers, you are averse to drinking at this time of day, and you will wish to oversee the arrangements for the unfortunate man's committal to the deep.
Yes.
Your health, Mr. Talbot. You will be willing to sign, or rather countersign, a report?
Well, I have no official standing in this ship.
Oh, come, Mr. Talbot.
I will make a statement and sign that. Yet you mentioned informants, Captain Anderson.
Did I say anything, Mark?
Oh, but you asked Mr. Summers.
Who replied there were none? None at all, Mr. Talbot. Not a man jack among them. Do you understand, sir? No one has come sneaking to me, no one. You can go, Hawkins.
Thank you, sir.
Servants have ears, Mr. Talbot.
Oh, certainly, sir. I'm very sure my fellow Wheeler has.
Wheeler? Oh, yes, indeed. That man must have ears and eyes all over him.
Well, then, until this afternoon's sad ceremony, I shall return to my journal.
Do not forget to include, Mr. Talbot, whatever may be said of the passengers, as far as the people and my officers are concerned, this is a happy ship.
At 3 o'clock, we were all assembled in the waist. The ship's bell was struck, and a party of sailors appeared, bearing the body on a plank and under the Union flag. It was placed with its feet towards the starboard or honourable side, by which admirals and bodies make their exits. It was a longer body than I expected, but I have since been told that two of our remaining cannonballs were attached to the feet. At last the captain opened the prayer book and grunted a sour invitation to us to pray. I have never heard a service read so fast. Then, to the unmusical shrill of the boatswain's pipe, the plank was lifted and tilted, and the mortal remains of the Reverend Robert James Colley shot from under the Union flag and entered the water with a single loud putt, as if he had been the most experienced of divers. So the poor man's drama is done, and he stands there on his cannonballs, how many miles down, alone.
Phillips, where is Wheeler? I keep calling for him.
He cannot be found, sir.
He's being sought even now.
Mr. Talbot?
Our Summers.
A word in your ear, sir.
What?
Wheeler is dead. He is lost overboard.
Good God. How did that happen?
No one knows, sir. Apparently.
The man who knew everything. Oh, I shall miss him. At least no one can accuse me of having had a hand in this death.
No, sir, not you. Nor anyone else, I'm sure.
Wheeler's death, like so much else in this ship, remains a mystery. But one thing at least has become clear. Later that night, Deverell came to my cabin.
Mr. Talbot,
I have some necessary observations of the captain's history for your journal, if you'd be so good.
He was not so drunk to be unaware of the danger in which he was placing himself.
That is a noble family, Mr. Talbot. You'd know them if I told you the name. The father of the present young lord kept a sweet little creature as his mistress. But he found himself in need of a fortune, and the price of his lucrative marriage was the dismissal of the sweet lady. Fortunately, one of his livings became available with the death of the incumbent on the hunting field, so his lordship presented it to his son's tutor, a dull sort of fellow, together with the lady and her enwombed child. So the lord got his fortune, the lady a husband, and the Reverend Anderson a living, a wife, and an heir.
Anderson?
Who was sent to sea, and by the interest of his natural father, elevated in the service. Now his half-brother has the fortune, and he has this. Do you wonder he hates the clergy?
I do not care to find excuses for Anderson. The beach is too good for him.
When we get to Sydney Cove, I shall call him out and shoot him dead. Because I can knock a crow off a steeple with one barker. And you, my good Edmund, must put the whole story down in your famous journal.
Then, of course, not without some shame, I understood Devil's jest. Was I not planning exactly the same thing for Miss Zenobia with poor Collie? I do not care as much for Devereux as I did. It was a misjudgment on my part to esteem him. The captain has asked us to perform a play to entertain the people, which has thrown me much into the company of Miss Granham. She and Prettyman have become engaged. They seem to have fallen in love after their fashion.
It is a great shame Collie has died, madam, or he could have married you.
I don't think so, Mr. Summers. He was a truly degraded man.
Oh, come, ma'am. De mortuis. A single unlucky indulgence. The man was harmless enough.
A priest harmless?
I was not referring to drink, but vice in another form.
Oh, ma'am, I cannot believe. As a lady, you cannot...
Do you doubt a lady's what, sir?
Oh, no, of course not.
Let it be, dear Mr. Prettyman. I beg you.
No, ma'am, I cannot let it go. I will have an apology.
You have it, ma'am, unreservedly.
We learned of his vicious habits accidentally. You will remember, Miss Granham, we were discussing the inevitability of the process by which true liberty must lead to true equality.
Mm.
And then... but that is no matter. These sailors were unaware of us, so that we heard all.
Smoking is bad enough, but at least gentlemen go no further.
Dear Miss Granham...
It is as savage a custom, sir, as any known.
By Jove, madam, you cannot mean the fellow chewed tobacco.
It is true. On one of my earlier visits, I saw a large bunch of leaf tobacco hung from the deckhead. It was spoiled by mildew and I threw it overboard.
Thomas, I saw no tobacco, and that kind of matter...
I assure you, sir, it was before you visited it.
You shall have the facts, sir. You shall have the words the sailor spoke.
No, no, spare us, I beg you. It is of little moment, after all.
Little moment? When it is a lady's word? One said to the other, Billy Rogers was laughing like a bilge pump when he come away from the captain. Billy said he'd knowed most things in his time, but he'd never thought to get a chew of a parson.
I do not know how to write this. I now understand what happened to pitiable, clownish Collie. It was night. I was heated and restless. I went back over the whole affair, and certain words and phrases kept coming back to me. In Collie's letter...
What a man does defiles him, not what is done by others.
And Roger's apparent astonishment at the inquiry.
What did we do, my lord?
Then Collie again.
He could be no other than a king. I abdicated freely and yearned to kneel before him.
And Summers.
On one of my earlier visits, I saw a large bunch of leaf tobacco hung from the deckhead.
Summers had guessed. There was no leaf tobacco. He was trying to protect the man's memory. Finally, Roger's reported speech.
Billy said he'd knowed most things in his time, but he'd never thought to get a chew of a parson.
Doubtless the young Hercules consented jeeringly and encouraged the ridiculous schoolboy trick. Even so, it was not Rogers, but Collie, who committed the fellatio that the poor fool was to die of when he remembered it. Poor, poor Collie. Made an equatorial fool of. Deserted by me, who could have saved him. overcome by kindness and a gill or two of the intoxicant. I shall write a letter to Miss Colley. It will be lies from beginning to end. How is that for a start to a career in the service of my king and country? It is the last page of your journal, my lord. It has become, perhaps, some kind of sea story. But a sea story with never a tempest, no shipwreck, no sinking, no rescue at sea, no sight or sound of an enemy, no thundering broadsides, gallant defences and heroic attacks. Only one gun fired, and that a blunderbuss. But in the not too ample volume of man's knowledge of man, let this sentence be inserted. Men can die of shame. The book is filled, all but a finger's breadth. I shall lock it, wrap it in sailcloth, and thrust it away in the locked drawer. With lack of sleep and too much understanding, I grow a little crazy, I think. Like all men at sea, who live too close to each other, and too close thereby to all that is monstrous under the sun and moon.
In episode 3 of Rites of Passage by William Golding, Talbot was played by Samuel West, Parson Colley by Simon Russell Beale, and Captain Anderson by Kenneth Haig. Lieutenant Summers was Barnaby Kay, Cumbersham and Mr. Smiles, Strew and Roger, Deverell, Roger May, Miss Granham, Alison Skilbeck, Billy Rogers, Richard Lang, Old Meadow, Charles Edwards, Mr. Taylor, Julian Morris, and Prettyman, Phillips, East and Hawkins, Max Digby. The executive producer was Richard Blake. Rites of Passage was adapted for radio and directed by Don Taylor and was an independent production by First Rights Radio for BBC Radio 4.